From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
To be a climate denier in 2016 is to simply ignore science. A businessman is supposed to be flexible and thoughtful about opportunity. Clean energy is an economic boom, and it's a boom for equity around the planet. And to turn your back on that is to put ideology over simple, good, clean energy business and clean energy jobs.
The science envoy for the U.S. State Department has resigned in protest of President Trump. The first letter of each paragraph of his resignation letter spells out the word impeach. We'll speak to Dan Kamen about his resignation, Charlottesville, how Trump's climate policy threatens the world, and the massive hurricane racing toward Texas. Then to Florida, when the state has just executed a man despite protests from pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson about using one of its drugs in an execution last night. Meanwhile, in Missouri, the governor stayed in execution after new DNA evidence. Plus, the White House has drafted a memo on implementing President Trump's ban on transgender people serving in the U.S. military.
Well, it seems that what the president is saying is that he is going to fire 15,000 highly trained, motivated troops. It is a catastrophe for military readiness.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Texas, tens of thousands of residents began evacuating coastal communities Thursday as forecasters predicted Hurricane Harvey could make landfall late Friday as a major Category 3 storm, delivering a life-threatening 35 inches of rain to some parts of the Gulf Coast. Texas Governor Greg Abbott called out 700 members of the National Guard as several coastal counties ordered mandatory evacuations. Hurricane trackers expect the storm's eye to come ashore near the city of Corpus Christi, where Mayor Joe McComb called for a voluntary evacuation.
So we are recommending in the strongest terms that if you live in those low-lying areas, that you get out and you begin to get out now. Go to a resident, I mean, a family member, a friend, somewhere, just get to higher ground. And so we're requesting that you do that. Again, this is on a voluntary basis.
Some computer models predict Harvey could stall over Texas, delivering catastrophic flooding before drifting back over the Gulf of Mexico towards Louisiana. In New Orleans, Mayor Mitch Landrieu admitted Thursday turbines and pumps needed to drain low-lying parts of the city remain below capacity after torrential downpours flooded parts of New Orleans earlier this month. Climate scientists say human-driven global warming is leading to more intense storms and increasing the maximum intensity of rainfall. In Florida, prison officials Thursday injected a 53-year-old condemned prisoner with a lethal dose of an anesthetic never before used in a U.S. execution. At 6:10 p.m. Eastern Time, Mark James Essay was strapped to a gurney and administered the drug etomidate. Witnesses say Essay twitched his legs briefly, appeared to breathe rapidly before his death was declared at 6:22 p.m. Etomidate was developed by Janssen, a division of Johnson & Johnson, and has been criticized as being unproven in executions. In response, the company said, quote, "We do not condone the use of our medicines in lethal injections for capital punishment." Mark James Essay was the first white man to be put to death in Florida for killing a black man since the state reinstituted the death penalty in 1979. We'll have more on the death penalty, last night's execution in Florida, later in the broadcast. At the White House, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Thursday President Trump would ask Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, to try again to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act when Congress returns from its summer recess next month. The comments came as President Trump continued to attack McConnell on Twitter and amidst reports that a phone call between Trump and McConnell earlier this month devolved into a profane shouting match. During Thursday's White House press briefing, the first in 3 weeks, Huckabee Sanders was also asked about Trump's threat to shut down the federal government if Congress doesn't pay for an expanded wall on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Sarah, on this threat of the government shutdown if Congress doesn't secure funding for this wall, How is that not a concession from this White House that Mexico isn't actually going to pay for this wall and American taxpayers will?
But again, this is something the president's committed to. He's committed to protecting American lives, and doing that through the border wall is something that's important. It's a priority, and we're moving forward with it.
But he's not saying that Mexico is going to pay for it.
He hasn't said they're not either.
Meanwhile, immigrant rights advocates say President Trump could soon cancel DACA, deferred action for childhood arrivals, a policy granting legal protection to nearly 800,000 young undocumented immigrants to live and work in the United States. The acting heads of the Department of Homeland Security and ICE met this week to discuss DACA's future as Republican governors from 10 states threatened to sue the Trump administration if it doesn't cancel DACA by September 5th. It's not clear whether Trump and Attorney General Jeff Sessions would mount a defense of DACA in court, and the federal judge who would preside over a court challenge, Andrew Hanen, previously ruled against President Obama's immigration policies. Meanwhile, McClatchy reported this week that top Trump advisors, including General John Kelly, his chief of staff, Jared Kushner, and Ivanka Trump, are pushing a deal that would preserve DACA in exchange for legislation that pays for a border wall and more detention facilities, curbs legal immigration, and implements the E-Verify program to check immigration status. In response, Lorella Priele of the American Civil Liberties Union said, quote, "We have 800,000 examples of why DACA strengthens America and why this program should stay in place. DACA is successful, popular, and constitutional, and should stay on the books until Congress passes a clean legislative solution to address Dreamer's status," she said. A coalition of U.S. rabbis has canceled its annual presidential conference call ahead of the Jewish High Holy Days, protesting President Trump's response to a march of white supremacists and neo-Nazis in Charlottesville earlier this month. In a joint statement, four rabbinical organizations took exception to Trump's claim that both sides were to blame for deadly violence and that there were very fine people among the white supremacists. The rabbis wrote, quote, "The president's words have given succor to those who advocate anti-Semitism, racism, and xenophobia. Responsibility for the violence that occurred in Charlottesville, including the death of Heather Heyer, does not lie with many sides, but with one side, the Nazis. Nazis, alt-right, and white supremacists who brought their hate to a peaceful community," the rabbis wrote. In St. Louis, police have arrested a man accused of driving his car into a group of protesters as they marched to honor an African-American transgender woman who was killed by a St. Louis police officer. Police charged 59-year-old Mark Kalau with a felony count of resisting arrest and two misdemeanor charges of leaving the scene of an accident and operating a vehicle in a careless manner. Surveillance video of the incident shows a car driving slowly through a crowd of demonstrators in an intersection, stopping for several seconds before accelerating at high speed through the intersection and turning left. At least three people were injured in the incident, which came just weeks after anti-racist protester Heather Heyer was struck and killed by a neo-Nazi terrorist in Charlottesville. Meanwhile, Republican operative and Trump associate Roger Stone said Thursday lawmakers attempting to impeach President Trump would be met with armed insurrection. Stone was speaking with the celebrity news service TMZ.
"Try to impeach him. Just try it. You will have a spasm of violence in this country, an insurrection like you've never seen."
"You think?"
"No question."
"You think if you got impeached, like, the country
both
would go
down?" "Sides are heavily armed, my friend. Yes, absolutely."
Some Democratic Congress members have introduced or plan to introduce articles of impeachment against Trump. They include Brad Sherman of California, Congressman Al Green of Texas, and Congressman Steve Cohen of Tennessee. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke Thursday recommended shrinking the size of several national monuments while leaving open the prospect of allowing drilling, mining, and other industries in the protected sites. The Trump administration has yet to release details of the plans, which could affect up to 27 national monuments. Secretary Zinke said only he was recommending changes to a handful of sites. In a statement, the Center for Biological Diversity said, quote, "Trump and Zinke are hiding the report so they don't have to face public backlash for trying to sell out America's public lands to fossil fuel development and logging. They're asking for a court battle, and they'll get one," unquote. Meanwhile, in Brazil, President Michel Temer has abolished a vast reserve of tropical rainforest in what conservationists are calling the biggest attack on the Amazon of the last 50 years. The move ends protections for the Renca Reserve, a swath of rainforest the size of Denmark, and paves the way for road building, mining and logging. In Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, President Trump's son-in-law and senior adviser Jared Kushner met Thursday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is under criminal investigation, and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, in what the Trump administration billed as an attempt to restart the U.S.-brokered peace talks. Kushner is a 36-year-old real estate magnate who's assumed a major diplomatic role in the Trump administration despite having no previous diplomatic experience. Kushner's visit came as Israeli authorities demolished a school in the West Bank village of Jubet Adib, forcing about 80 Palestinian children to begin the school year in cramped tents or under the hot sun. Israeli authorities said the school's six newly installed cabins, which were donated by the European Union, had been built without proper permits. The United Nations called Thursday for a pause in fighting around the Syrian city of Raqqa, where U.S.-led coalition attacks have killed hundreds of civilians held hostage by ISIS fighters. The U.N.'s humanitarian advisor for Syria, John Eglund, has said an estimated 20,000 civilians are trapped in dire circumstances.
The civilian casualties are large. And there seem to be no real escape for these civilians. I cannot think of a worse place on earth now than in these five neighborhoods for these 20,000 people.
In Bahrain, human rights groups are calling for the release of jailed political activist Ibtissam Al-Sayed, saying she's been beaten and sexually assaulted since her arrest on trumped-up terrorism charges last May. Amnesty International has called her a prominent human rights advocate whose only crime is speaking out against abuses in Bahrain. The Gulf nation is a close U.S. ally, home to the Navy's Fifth Fleet. And in Peru, police fired tear gas and water cannons to break up a protest by hundreds of striking teachers near the National Congress in Lima Thursday. The teachers have been on strike for more than 2 months, demanding salary increases, better working conditions, and the repeal of an education reform law that limits the rights of teachers. This is Sonia Arcano, one of the strikers.
We're teachers who want to be truly recognized for what we are. Enough of being trampled on like this. Look at this teacher here, a hurt teacher. Enough. Enough, sir, enough.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The science envoy for the U.S. State Department, Dan Kamen, has resigned in protest of President Trump's refusal to quickly condemn the deadly white supremacist violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, earlier this month. In his resignation letter, Kamen writes, quote, "Your presence in the White House harms the United States domestically and abroad and threatens life on the planet," unquote. The first letter of each paragraph of his resignation letter spells out the word impeach. This is now resigned science envoy Dan Kamen speaking to Democracy Now! During the 2016 climate change summit in Marrakesh, Morocco, just after President Trump was elected.
To be a climate denier in 2016 is to simply ignore science. A businessman is supposed to be flexible and thoughtful about opportunity. Clean energy is an economic boom, and it's a boom for equity around the planet. And to turn your back on that is to put ideology over simple, good, clean energy business and clean energy jobs.
For more, we go to San Francisco, where we're joined by Daniel Kamen, just resigned as science envoy for the State Department, professor of energy at the University of California, Berkeley. Daniel Kamen, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about why, at this point, you have decided to resign as science envoy for the State Department.
Well, thanks for having me back on. My decision was really a culmination. I was initially, of course, very concerned when the president pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. I did want to give a chance to see if the statement that he made, he wanted to engage with the process and see if there was a quote-unquote better deal for the United States, although I actually think that the deal was very well done, as is. We, in fact, designed quite a bit of it. But the larger feature was that I never saw that re-engagement to discuss the deal in detail. And as we moved further into this presidency, we've seen the events in Charlottesville that clearly were a big step away from positive engagement, finding opportunities to diffuse hatred. And those features are sadly, in my view, very consistent with this stepping away from international partnerships in the Paris Climate Accord. Those events, then the speech the president gave in Arizona, were simply too much of a pattern, in my view, of not looking for opportunities to build these partnerships, to recognize the opportunities of clean jobs, of equity, and chances to move away from divisiveness. And that's why I did not feel that I could fulfill the position of science envoy focused on energy and climate in Africa and the Middle East under this administration.
How do you see Charlottesville connected to the issues that, well, you're in the State Department for, or you were, science envoy?
Well, I think they're actually very closely connected. The goal of the State Department is diplomacy, building bridges, finding opportunities to identify points of tension and rise above, whether that's through additional mediation, whether that's through finding the challenges that both sides are facing. But I think what we saw with the president's comments after Charlottesville was, in fact, fanning the flames, if you will, of that divisiveness, of not calling out the alt-right, the neo-Nazis for what they were, and to trying to spread the blame around when it was very clearly how this particular event was exacerbated. And that pattern is very much like not taking the Paris Climate Accord and seeing it as a way to build bridges overseas, whether they're on the political level with negotiations or whether they're business-to-business interactions. And that's what really connects these types of events, in my view.
Well, you join a number of people and organizations that are quitting. The entire President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities has resigned. They resigned last week, becoming the first entire presidential committee to resign in protest. In their resignation letter, the artists spoke out against Trump's failure to quickly condemn the deadly white supremacist violence in Charlottesville, writing, quote, "The administration's refusal to quickly and unequivocally condemn the cancer of hatred only further emboldens those who wish America ill." They also called on Trump to step down. The first letter of each paragraph of their letter spells out the word resist. And then there is the Trump Advisory Councils. President Trump grew increasingly isolated when, well, he says he disbanded a pair of business advisory councils as more CEOs exited the groups in protests of Trump's failure to fully condemn white nationalists. After the heads of 3M and the Campbell Soup Company became the latest to resign, Trump tweeted, "Rather than putting pressure on the business people of the Manufacturing Council and Strategy and Policy Forum, I'm ending both. Thank you all." That's what he tweeted. But the story behind the scenes is that members of the council called Jared Kushner at the White House to say they were going to resign en masse. And it was at that point when he was notified, the son-in-law and senior advisor to President Trump, that Trump tweeted out that he was banning the two councils. So, Daniel Kamen, are you hearing about more people like yourself or whole councils or committees or entities that are weighing this right now?
I haven't heard of others that are considering it, but I do think the ones that you highlighted really speak for themselves in terms of this is a diverse range of issues, from the role of science to business leaderships actually pointed by the White House to the events of the Arts Council. And in fact, it was the Arts Council statement that inspired me to construct mine in the way that I did, because I thought that they eloquently and very clearly laid down a line that we expect a level of behavior from the White House that looks for opportunities to build bridges, not to divide. And that's really what Charlottesville brought into clarity for many of us.
So can you talk about your letter and the fact that the first letter of each of the paragraphs, your resignation letter, spells out the word impeach?
Absolutely. I mean, I write that as a private citizen. I'm not a member of the U.S. House of Representatives or the Senate. So I do it from perhaps not a legal perspective, but in my view, the goal of the White House is really to build opportunities, to build bridges. And when you're not doing that, when you're, in my view, harming the status of the United States internationally in terms of the Paris Climate Accord, which was just a very large success, and a success that the U.S. played a big role in bringing nations together, and then the events we've seen in Virginia, these are, to my mind, statements that really do speak to a leadership which is not putting the U.S. in the right light or moving in the right direction. And that's why I made the statement that I did.
So if we can talk to you, you're the now resigned science envoy of the State Department. But if we can talk to you about what's happening right now in Texas. Tens of thousands of residents began evacuating coastal communities as forecasters predict that Hurricane Harvey could make landfall late Friday as a major Category 3 storm, delivering a life-threatening 35 inches of rain to some parts of the Gulf Coast. Can you talk about this hurricane, what we're seeing, and whether you think it is related to climate change or global warming?
So this is an area where the science is still building. We certainly have seen a number of climatologists. I'm a physicist who works on clean energy solutions. But on the detection of climate change side, there's a building awareness of the degree to which climate change makes these types of tropical storms more severe, whether that's more frequent or whether that's stronger as an area that's still under research. But it's clear that events like this, increased wildfires, droughts, these are all what we expect to see in a globally warmed, a climate-changed world. And from my perspective, these are all economic and human, agricultural and environmental costs. And when we talk about not stepping up to the plate and acting based on the scientific knowledge to reduce our global warming footprint, to reduce the amount of pollution so that we can limit the effects of climate change, these are all huge economic costs for us, for the rest of the planet, that we are paying, and we're paying them already. And that's really the sad part of the story to me. We have a very clear global consensus that we need to reduce our emissions to get this, under the so-called two-degree target. That's about an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. It's a Herculean task. And every day that we delay and every bit of our economy that isn't looking to find opportunities to meet those targets, but also to build more jobs. We've already seen tremendous job growth in the clean tech sector in the United States, a number of countries. These are lost opportunities, and they're also costs where they're going to be paying far into the future.
So I want to ask you about the Paris Climate Accord. We saw you in Marrakesh the year after the Paris Climate Accord, and it was in November. It was just after President Trump was elected. So a little while later, once he became president, as is well known, Trump announced he would withdraw the U.S. from the landmark Paris Climate Accord that was signed by nearly 200 nations in 2015. This is what he said.
If today, the United States will cease all implementation of the non-binding Paris Accord and the draconian financial and economic burdens the agreement imposes on our country. This includes ending the implementation of the nationally determined contribution and, very importantly, the Green Climate Fund, which is costing the United States a vast fortune.
That was President Trump announcing that the U.S. will pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. Daniel Kamen, the significance of this now.
Well, there's a couple levels. One is that we've seen very clearly that investments in clean energy, in being more efficient with water and agriculture, in finding ways to clean our cities, are all things that actually pay us back. In fact, there's study after study indicating that the jobs benefit of investing in the green economy is really very large. And we've seen that domestically. We've seen that in efforts in other countries. And so to step away from the Paris Climate Accord was disappointing on many environmental levels, but it was also disappointing on a very fundamental economic level. And this is the economy of the future. The U.S. has invested a great deal in energy research over the years. And to step away now when it's paying off is economic folly as well as environmentally incredibly dangerous and risky. It's
so
very
disappointing
to see.
You were in the State Department, right? The Secretary of State, of course, is Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of ExxonMobil. What's been going on in the State Department around climate change? You are one person, as you pointed out. You're the science envoy. But what is happening? What is his position? Does it matter, given President Trump's position? And in academia, have you seen science and climate grants cut? You're a professor at University of California, Berkeley.
Right. So to walk through those. In the State Department, there's actually a very, very small team. There was a robust team under the last several presidents working on aspects of this. But under this president, the offices that deal directly on the international negotiations, that look for these business opportunities, these leadership opportunities, is essentially non-existent. So there is very little work going on, despite the fact that Secretary Tillerson had actually made some quite positive comments about this process before becoming Secretary of State. He had said previously that a price on carbon would be a good thing, which is essentially universally agreed on in not only the research community, but the business community in the United States, in Asia and Europe. And then in the academic realm, we have not yet seen clear budget cuts in this area because we're largely living on the budgets right now that came out under President Obama. But we've all heard statements about potentially draconian cuts at State Department, Department of Energy, and the Environmental Protection agencies that are on the 30-40% range have been reported in the news. And these are all not just big cuts, but they're cuts that would take place right when we see these investments really paying off at the federal and the state level.
I wanted to ask you about one of our headlines today, Brazil, the president, Michel Temer, abolishing a vast reserve of tropical rainforests in what conservationists are calling the biggest attack on the Amazon of the last 50 years, the move ending protections for the Renca Reserve, a swath of rainforest the size of Denmark, paving the way for road building, mining and logging. Talk also about what this could mean, Daniel Kamen.
Well, there's two things. One is that Brazil, previous to this, had actually been reducing the rate of deforestation in the Amazon. They'd gotten a number of international accolades and had seen their efforts to cut into deforestation, if you will, really pay off. This is a step in the exact opposite direction. And you can really argue that when the international community is moving towards investing in sustainability, in greater protection for indigenous minority communities, that direction was really working well. And so what you're seeing in Brazil and in the United States stepping away from Paris is really a weakening or a rejection or an attack on this approach to sustainability that works across sectors and, as we've seen, makes our economy more resilient, makes it more inclusive. And so the Brazil story is a sad reversal, just as that by Mr. Trump.
Will the Trump administration, as far as you know, it's now August, the UN climate summit will take place in Bonn in November. Will the Trump administration be sending a delegation?
Well, we don't know yet. We are certainly working at the level of researchers, both in universities across the country, in the business sector. There will certainly be people who are planning to go. Many of them will be planning to go as government representatives, as they've done in the past, and we'll find out. The other feature, though, is that we are seeing what I would regard as the Paris deal from below. Governor Brown in California is the co-chair of the Under 2 Memorandum of Understanding, the Under 2 Accords, which are commitments at the state or city or provincial levels around the world to meet the Paris Climate Accord on their own. I work with governments in East Africa, in Southeast Asia, many U.S. states, European areas that are all taking this on. And in fact, this under 2 MOU now constitutes about 40% of the global economy, 300 municipalities worldwide. Governor Brown in California and Baden-Württemberg in Germany are the co-chairs. And so what I think you're seeing is a reaction and a response to double down and demonstrate resolve at the levels that are actionable today. And that puts many of these same people back into the process. But it would be so much more economically beneficial for the United States to take this on as an overall mission. It is, after all, what the science is telling us and has told us. And acting on good science is what I believe enlightened leaders should do.
Daniel Kamen, are you encouraging other members of the Trump administration to quit, as you have?
I think that's really a personal decision based on your own position and your own effectiveness. I certainly think that, for me, it was the right statement. And if an office is not moving in a positive direction, I think you have to really take a hard look. Can you do more work outside the system? I personally very much value federal service. I would dearly love to go back to federal service under this or a next administration that takes this on as an opportunity for the United States, not as an opportunity to bury one's head in the sand. But I think individuals should really look at their own relationship with this administration and decide for themselves.
Daniel Kamen, I want to thank you for being with us. Just resigned as science envoy for the State Department, professor of energy and at the University of California, Berkeley, speaking to us from San Francisco. We'll link to your resignation letter. The first letter of each paragraph spells out the word impeach. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll look at the death penalty in Florida and in Missouri. Stay with us. EMA here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. By the way, if you want to sign up for our daily digest, our news headlines and news alerts, you can just text the word Democracy Now! Without a space in it, Democracy Now! To the number 66866. That's Democracy Now! 66866. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to look at what took place in Florida last night, on Thursday evening, the state of Florida executed a 53-year-old man convicted of killing two men in 1987 by lethal injection. According to officials, Mark James Essay was pronounced dead at 6:22 p.m. The execution protocol, which began at 6:10 p.m., included a drug never before used in a U.S. execution. The anesthetic drug, etomidate, was developed by a division of Johnson & Johnson called Janssen and has been criticized as being unproven in an execution. In response, the Johnson & Johnson division wrote, quote, "We do not condone the use of our medicines in lethal injections for capital punishment." Etomidate replaced midazolam, which has been used in multiple botched executions. Johnson & Johnson joined a chorus of drug companies that have taken steps to prevent their medicines from being used in U.S. executions. After European pharmaceutical companies began refusing to sell drugs to be used in executions, many states turned to untested drug combinations and drugs sourced through unconventional means. The controversial lethal injection formulas used may have subjected at least one prisoner to an excruciating excruciating death equivalent to drowning. Mark James Assay, who's a white supremacist with swastika tattoos, was the first white man to be put to death in Florida for killing a black man since Florida reinstituted the death penalty in 1979. Executions in Florida were put on hold after the Supreme Court ruled that the old system was unconstitutional because it gave judges, not juries, the power to decide. Since then, Florida's legislature passed a law requiring a unanimous jury for death penalty recommendations. Jurors recommended Assay for the death penalty by a vote of 9-3. Florida ruled the Supreme Court's ruling did not apply to older cases. Assay was the 24th prisoner executed under Florida Governor Rick Scott, the most under any Florida governor. Well, for more, we go to London, England, where we're joined by Maya Foa. She's director of international legal charity Reprieve. Maya, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about this execution, what took place, and the drugs that were used?
Yes. Well, this was the first time ever that that particular cocktail of drugs, etomidate plus a paralytic agent, and then the drug potassium acetate, had been used in an execution anywhere in the world. And it was chosen amid really vocal concerns by numerous pharmaceutical manufacturers, distributors, healthcare professionals, people across the spectrum, including last week Johnson & Johnson Company, which designed etomidate in the first place. And they felt the need to speak out and say, we didn't make it for this purpose. This is an inappropriate use. Experts have said that this is the riskiest protocol they have ever seen. So the first execution took place last night. We really don't know how it went. And that's one of the fundamental problems with the lethal injection is that so much of the design of the cocktail, whether it be the cocktail they used in the 70s or the cocktails they're now turning to, the design contains this paralytic agent, which is there purely for a cosmetic purpose, purely so that we, the spectators, anybody watching the execution, trying to establish what's really going on, are unable to see whether there has been pain and suffering. The inmate is paralyzed. Their voluntary muscles are paralyzed. So they can't shout out if, as we fear happens a lot, the first drug doesn't anesthetize the prisoner. So he or she is awake, there, strapped to the gurney, as the third drug, a powerful acid that the Supreme Court has said would be unconstitutional to use if the inmate were not properly anesthetized, is administered. It's like Justice Sotomayor compared it to being burnt alive at the stake from the inside, chemical being burnt alive at the stake.
So you have been deeply involved now with trying to get particularly European companies to tell the United States they will not allow their drugs to be used to execute people. Explain the approach you've taken, how you have really led to the shortage of execution drugs in America.
Well, what's interesting about the lethal injection is that actually manufacturers have never wanted their medicines used in executions. And that shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. These companies make drugs to save and improve the lives and health of patients. So what happened in 2010, when states began to run out of a particular drug, they moved over. They started to buy drugs from a driving school in London. So at that stage, I started to look into the supply chain and realized very quickly that the companies the legitimate manufacturers who are making these products do not want them used to kill prisoners, and not just to kill prisoners, but sometimes to torture and end the lives of prisoners. So what we have done, what I have done working with companies, now over 30 global manufacturers, is work together with them to help them protect their medicines from this lethal misuse. You imagine, you're a company, you make medicines that are designed to advance wellness, to improve lives, to save lives, and you have states who are diverting your products against your will. And you have said many, many times, this has been going on for decades, you've said many times, you don't want your drugs used for this purpose. They divert the drugs, they use them to sometimes torture and kill prisoners. And that is not only bad for you in corporate terms, in commercial terms, you risk legal liability, and it's fundamentally opposite to what you've spent your entire time. You've got scientists, you've got doctors, you've got people working in this company to make products to save lives.
So I have helped scores of companies design distribution controls that enable them to direct where the drugs go so that they go to legitimate medical users of the drugs, hospitals, acute care facilities, and that they're not diverted to prisons who use those medicines to torture and kill prisoners.
So talk about some of those companies, for example, Lundbeck.
Lundbeck was a company, is a company that makes pentobarbital, made pentobarbital, and they were deeply opposed to the use of their medicines in executions. This was around 2011 when states started to move to pentobarbital because there was a shortage, a domestic shortage of sodium thiopental. Lundbeck said from the outset, we don't want our drugs used in executions. And then over the course of a few months, designed and implemented distribution controls to prevent their drugs being used to kill prisoners in Texas, Missouri, and elsewhere. They were aware that this drug, pentobarbital, again, an experimental new drug, it hadn't been used in executions before. The combination, the way in which it was being used in certain states, you would not even have been allowed to do that to an animal. The American Veterinary Medical Association forbids the use of these combinations of drugs, including the paralytic agent that I mentioned, to euthanize animals. And yet states were saying that this was the appropriate way to end the lives of prisoners on death row. So Lundbeck put in place the controls. They announced them in July of 2011. And states that had a supply of pentobarbital used that supply for a couple of years until the drugs expired. The drugs expired, all of them, in 2013. And because the controls have been effective, states haven't been able to get pentobarbital anymore. And that's why we've started to see the changes to new protocols. Our concern, of course, is that these new protocols are not better or safer or more efficacious or more pleasing to the industry than any of the other protocols. And really what we should be seeing is state agencies heeding the increasingly vocal and numerous calls and aggressive calls from the industry saying, we don't want these medicines used in this way. And they should be respecting the interests of business. And they should be moving away from this misuse, you know, this lethal misuse of medicines.
I wanted to talk about another death penalty case earlier this week. The Missouri governor issued a last-minute stay of execution for death row prisoner Marcellus Williams, only hours before he was slated to be put to death Tuesday night. The stay of execution came after DNA found on the murder weapon did not match Williams, but instead matched another man. Williams, who's African-American, was convicted in 2001 of killing a former St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporter named Leisha Gale, who is white, during a robbery. He was convicted by 11 white jurors and one black juror after the prosecution was allowed to preemptively strike out six other prospective black jurors. Williams has always maintained his innocence. Amnesty International and other groups are now urging Missouri Governor Eric Greitens to grant Marcellus Williams clemency. For more, we're going to Kansas City, Missouri, where we're joined by Kent Gibson, a criminal defense attorney who's been representing Marcellus Williams for the past 12 years. Kent Gibson, welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about what happened this week and the DNA evidence that was finally allowed to be used to weigh in here in Marcellus Williams' case in a stay of execution.
Well, thank you for having me. I've been representing Marcellus for about 12 years now, and we had been trying to get new DNA testing during that entire time. And finally, in 2015, we succeeded in doing that. And through the new technique called touch DNA, a DNA profile was developed on the knife handle, and it matched was an unknown male, but it did not match Marcellus Williams' DNA.
Now, he has been in jail for, what, 17 years about? How come this just came out on the day that he was going to be executed?
Well, we had the results, and we tried to get a stay from the Missouri Supreme Court, who summarily denied it. So we could get a court hearing, because we've never gotten a court hearing to have a trial judge or any other judge evaluate whether the DNA is sufficiently exonerating to warrant a new trial. And the case was in the United States Supreme Court when the governor stayed the execution and appointed a board of inquiry, which he has the right to do under Missouri law, to review the facts and make a recommendation to him as to what he ought to do as far as either commuting the sentence, or he could go so far as to pardon him, or at the very least order a new trial.
So can you talk about the massive social media campaign that was waged to encourage the governor to give Marcellus Williams a stay of execution?
Yes. Our new governor is a younger guy, and he's changed the way the governor's office operates. He very rarely speaks to the press. He's like Donald Trump in some ways. He communicates with the public through Instagram and Twitter and things like that. So we enlisted Sister Helen Prejean and some other people who are savvy in the social media world. And the last 3 or 4 days before the execution, from what I understand, the governor was being bombarded with responses, texts, phone calls, and there were over 200,000 signatures on an online petition. And I think, given that the governor is very sensitive to social media, I think that really made a difference.
So can you talk about what happens next, Kent Gibson?
At this point, the governor had indicated he's going to appoint 5 retired judges to act as a board of inquiry to hear all the evidence in the case and then make a recommendation to him as to what he ought to do. I don't know how fast that's going to happen. We're sort of in uncharted waters. This law has been on the books since the 60s, but it's only been invoked once, and it didn't involve a claim of innocence. It dealt with a mentally ill inmate back in the 90s. So we don't know exactly how this is going to proceed, whether we're going to have a right to appear before them, whether he'll have a right to counsel. We do know by statute that it's not going to be a public hearing, and the recommendation that they make is not going to be made public, which is a bit of a concern because we don't know exactly what the ground rules are going to be for this entire proceeding.
You're concerned about the issue of racial bias in the original trial with the 11 white jurors and 1 black juror. Why was there just 1 black juror?
Because the prosecution, which has been the habit of the St. Louis County prosecutors, and particularly in death penalty cases involving African-American defendants, they use their peremptory strikes where they can strike jurors for any reason to remove blacks from the jury. And in most of the capital cases that have come out of that county in the last 15 or 20 years, most of them have had all-white juries. Marcellus had 1 black juror just because they didn't have enough strikes to get rid of all of them. But St. Louis County, as everybody may remember, is the same county that we had the Ferguson police shooting incident a couple of years ago. So there have been racial issues and controversies surrounding the criminal justice system in that county for years, and it sort of came to a head with the Michael Brown shooting, and the prosecutor, Mr. McCullough, was involved in that and was also is probably one of the most pro-death penalty prosecutors in the entire state at a time where the death penalty is waning in popularity and prosecutors aren't seeking it nearly as often. He's an exception. He's never seen a death penalty he didn't like.
Finally, Marcellus Williams, his response to his stay of execution. Did you deliver the news to him?
Yes. Well, I was the second. The other lawyer on the case was actually at the prison, so he told him in person, and then I talked to him on the phone a little later, and his reaction is how it's always been. He's very calm and very devout Muslim. He's basically said all along, fight for my life, but whatever happens, it would be God's will.
Maya Foa, I want to end with you. You're in London, England, as you listen to this, but you've taken on these cases in the United States trying to get execution drugs stopped being used here in this country. Why do you care about what goes on here, and how unusual is the death penalty?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. I'm actually American, so I care as an American citizen, too. But I think this is a really interesting issue. We work on cases around the world. And in America, this myth of the humane lethal injection is deeply troubling to me for a number of different reasons. You know, there's something about the way in which the design of the cocktail, the medicalization of the death penalty, has allowed it to be sustained in America for far longer than I think otherwise you might have had capital punishment. We don't have it here in the UK. And in lots of other countries where they do have capital punishment, they've looked at the lethal injection and decided not to go that way because they've seen that it's not actually a humane way to kill. So I think there's a very important job to be done in exposing the hypocrisy of that method, where really prisoners are being—they are suffering torturous executions, in large part because certain states don't want to face the reality of what it means to kill people. So that's one dimension that I think is extremely important. The other side, of course, is that we're dealing with manufacturers. We're in a global society now, and these manufacturers are multinationals. So back in 2010, when I started looking into this, it was British drugs that were being diverted and used in executions. One of the first executions that I really looked into, there were drugs that had been exported from the UK, from the back room of a driving school. And these drugs were used to kill a young man whose autopsy photos I later saw, and his eyes were wide open in the autopsy. Now, what that means is that the first drug, the drugs that had come from the driving school, had not worked effectively. So he was awake, conscious, when the second drug was administered, and he was paralyzed. Then the third drug, this powerful acid that I talked about, that is fire in the veins. That is an unbelievable amount of suffering that he was exposed to. And nobody knew, because the lethal injection disguises that. So the global nature of the industry means that these different companies and different countries are implicated by what looks to be a very local practice. Over the years, I've worked with companies in China, in Pakistan, in India, in Europe, of course. In America, the big giants, Pfizer, McKesson, Johnson & Johnson, these are pharmaceutical companies, regardless of their political position. They don't take a political position on capital punishment, but they make medicines to save and improve the lives and health of patients. What states are doing is creating huge disruption to the industry, causing all sorts of problems for these companies, as well as having implications for the other countries where these companies are sat. So for various reasons, I think the death penalty, the U.S. practice of using the lethal injection, has made it a global issue. But I would care about it as an American also.
Maya Foa, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the group Reprieve in London, and Ken Gibson, criminal defense attorney for Marcellus Williams for the past 12 years. Thanks for joining us. Up next, the White House has drafted a memo on implementing President Trump's proposed ban on transgender people serving in the U.S. military. We'll find out more. Stay with us. The Way of the World by McCarthy here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to look at at President Trump's call to ban transgender people from serving in the U.S. military. The Wall Street Journal's reporting the White House has drafted a memo instructing the Pentagon to refuse to admit transgender people to the military and to stop paying for the medical treatments for transgender people who are currently serving in the military. The memo gives the Pentagon 6 months to implement the ban, which was first announced on Twitter by President Trump in late July, sparking widespread outrage and apparently surprise at the Pentagon. 5 transgender military members have already sued Trump over the ban. Thousands of transgender people are currently serving in the U.S. military. For more, we're joined by Chase Strangio, who is staff attorney at the ACLU. Chase, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Now, the Wall Street Journal is just reporting the existence of this memo. Yesterday, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said an announcement will be made. What about what has been outlined so far?
Well, again, I mean, so far, there's still no policy that we know of. Nothing has been transmitted to the Pentagon. But what we're hearing in terms of the nature of the policy that's being solidified is that it represents the same animus that we saw in the tweets. It is looking to ban people from enlisting, to restrict people's access to health care, and essentially restrict promotions and give the Department of Defense discretion to kick people out at will. So this is just the transparent discrimination that we've seen from the administration towards transgender individuals and so many others.
Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, a decorated military veteran who was severely injured in Iraq, is urging Congress to block Trump's announced ban. She wrote in a statement, "When I was bleeding to death in my Black Hawk helicopter after I was shot down, I didn't care if the American troops risking their lives to help save me were gay, straight, transgender, black, white or brown. All that mattered was they didn't leave me behind. If you are willing to risk your life for our country and you can do the job, you should be able to serve, no matter your gender identity or sexual orientation. Anything else is not just discriminatory, it's disruptive to our military, and it's counterproductive to our national security. If the president enacts this ban, which would harm our military readiness, the Democratic and Republican members of Congress who oppose this discrimination must enact legislation that prevents it from taking effect." That's what Senator Tammy Duckworth said. So, Chase Strangio, specifically talk about the issue of paying for medical care of transgender people in the military.
Well, first, I think it's important to remember that the House defeated an amendment to the NDA precisely on this issue just before the tweets. So the tweets represented the president's frustration and actually probably the vice president's frustration that they were not able to get such a ban through Congress. And now we see his sort of impulsive undermining of both the data, the science and everything else we know about transgender individuals serving and his proposal now to restrict access to health care. The reality is that the military has $1 billion in their budget for health care. This is a fraction of that. And what it reflects is a misunderstanding and discrimination of transgender individuals. But the costs are minimal. The care is necessary. There's a scientific, a medical, and a military consensus that this should be provided.
And what is that care?
The care really ranges, and this is just like any other medical care. It involves a patient and a doctor making a determination about mental health care, hormonal treatment and surgeries, many of which are already provided for other conditions that don't impact deployability any more than other conditions, and that we see these continued restrictions, both in the context of now the military and efforts to restrict the care under the Affordable Care Act and elsewhere under this administration, that reflects bias, not medicine, that reflects stigma, not legal standards, and we are absolutely going to continue to challenge these issues in court.
It would ban transgender people from signing up for being in the military.
The proposed ban that we're hearing from would ban enlistment, which could also implicate contract renewals of currently serving members, as well as restricting access to health care, as well as promotion. So it's essentially an effort to drive people out who are currently serving, restrict their benefits, and also ban current people who are interested in enlisting from doing so.
How are people organizing against this? Again, this memo has not been announced.
There's already one lawsuit pending. There are going to be many more lawsuits once this becomes official policy. And we're going to see people across the country resist the misinformation that this administration is circulating about transgender individuals and our health care, which is both medically necessary and life-saving.
The memo says that as for current trans troops, their leaders can expel them if they deem them not to be deployable. What does that mean?
It's not clear what that means. It sounds incredibly arbitrary, and there are already military regulations that bar separation based on a lack of universal deployability. So this is completely inconsistent with military policy.
Jay Stranger, thanks for joining us of the ACLU. And that does it for today's broadcast. A very happy birthday to Vesta Gadarz. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.